Now, before we do this, let's go over the ground rules. Rule number one, no touching of the hair or face.
Of course.
And that's it. Now, let's do this.
Hey. Three, four. Three, four.
Fun times in Cleveland today.
What is going on? Welcome to another edition of the Exiled Clevelander podcast. I am your host, Adam Copeland. Thank you, as always, for joining me. Great weekend, last weekend, to be a Cleveland sports fan. The Cavs, after looking a little shaky, starting off 1-3, bounced back with a 2-0 weekend. The return of Mo Williams certainly seemed to help as they got victories over Philadelphia and Washington, back-to-back road wins on back-to-back nights. And all of a sudden, 3-3, and they had the fortune, at least for one night, of being tops in the Central Division. So savor that flavor, Cleveland, because I have a feeling we're not going to be talking about the first place Cavs all that much this year. But for now, it's a nice thing to have. And of course, the Browns getting a huge victory, a pummeling of Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and the New England Patriots. The Browns dominated that game in every facet, winning it 34-14. And now they are 2-1 in games that rookie Colt McCoy has started. To me, this game may have actually been the most impressive victory that the Browns have had, not just under Eric Mangini, but since they've returned to the league in 1999. We've seen them win other big games, the Run William Run game against the Falcons that eventually got the Browns into the playoffs. They won that Monday nighter against the Giants a couple years ago after they got that terrible start. They won that game against Pittsburgh on Thursday night last year that was a very nice victory. But in terms of putting it all together at one time, I don't think another game matches what we experienced last week with the Browns. It really all came together, and the Browns simply dominated the Patriots in all phases of the game. When the Browns beat the Saints a couple weeks ago, I thought that it was nice, but I was a little skeptical. They won it, I don't want to say in a completely fluky manner because the defense played really well, but they forced a couple turnovers. They ran some crazy trick plays. They ran some special teams gimmicks. All of it worked, and all of it added up to a win over the defending Super Bowl champions. But I wasn't sure if that was a sustainable formula. I don't think it is a sustainable formula for wins in the NFL. But what we saw from the Browns on this past Sunday, that is a sustainable formula for wins in the NFL. Hard-nosed, rushing, physical play on both the offensive and defensive end. Smart play from the quarterback position. Smart play not taking boneheaded penalties and unnecessary timeouts. They put it all together, and at least for one week, the Browns are a very relevant team and are probably the most optimistic 3-5 football team in the NFL. I want to start the breakdown of this game in an unlikely place, not with Colt McCoy, but with the offensive line that was fantastic. They opened up 184 yards of rushing for Peyton Hillis. They kept McCoy on his feet the entire game. The Browns had over 200 yards rushing in this game as a total, and that wouldn't have been possible without a fantastic effort from the Browns' offensive line and from fullback Lawrence Vickers. That may have been the best effort from a Browns' offensive line that we have seen since 1999. And while this Patriots defense is not a particularly dominating unit, this is what the Browns need to do if they're going to win games. It was the formula that they had down the stretch last year when they won five in a row, and it's the formula that I think Eric Mangini wants to have as they move forward. Peyton Hillis was a beast, 29 attempts, 184 yards, two touchdowns. He also caught three passes for 36 yards. My only concern with Hillis, certainly not his talent, certainly not his will. I think he has those in abundance. He's not a traditional running back that you see in the NFL anymore. Doesn't have a lot of east to west juking type moves. He's a north-south runner, but I think there still is a place for that, as he is proving in today's NFL. My concern, though, with Hillis is whether or not he can take this type of physical play week in and week out and have 29, 30 carries week in and week out. The Browns are very thin at running back, and while I think the Browns can continue to improve, can continue what they have been doing the last few weeks, the one real concern is if Hillis sustains an injury. That would completely knock any progress that the Browns have had from week to week off the tracks. But if Hillis stays healthy, this team, in my opinion, is in excellent position to compete against every team that they play and to have at least a chance. Cleveland football is relevant once again. So it is a great feeling as a Browns fan to be able to actually look forward to watching your team play on Sundays. At the beginning of the season and past seasons, I don't know about you, I've often dreaded what was going to come. Now, they may not win from week to week, but I know that they are going to give it their all. They are clearly playing hard for each other and for the coaches. And I want to compliment the coaching staff. This was an extremely good performance from the coaching staff. And I have been an outspoken critic of the coaches up until the last couple of weeks. I blamed the coaches primarily for that 0-2 start, not the players. And I think in some ways this game vindicates me in a way. It's the same players, but the different types of schemes that the coaches have employed have really assisted this team, which is not the most talented team in the NFL, but played at an extremely high level, much higher than the team that actually had the best record in the NFL going in. And you know this one meant a lot to Eric Mangini, coaching against his former mentor, now estranged friend, Bill Belichick. Rob Ryan again broke out the exotic defense, the UFO defense, where no one puts their hand down on the ground. It confused the hell out of Drew Brees a couple of weeks ago, and it confused Tom Brady. His stats for Brady, 19 to 36, 224 yards, two touchdowns. Not terrible stats, but they don't really tell the whole story. He was never really able to get that Patriots offense in a groove when the Patriots needed to happen, and that was due to Rob Ryan in his defensive schemes. And Brian Daboll, probably the most criticized coach of this entire bunch, he had a very good day, including that bizarre play that they are now, I guess, calling Brownie. I've never seen a play like that in my life. It was something out of a middle school game where the offensive linemen just stand around and Chazney Stuckey's literally hiding behind Yates, the right guard, before he takes the handoff there and runs it around left tackle for a touchdown. Just a bizarre play. I had to watch it about three times to realize what the Browns had actually just pulled off. But major credit goes to Daboll. Again, when you don't have the most talent, you have to put them in the best position to win. I know I've sounded like a broken record with this. I've said it many times on the podcast. I'll continue to say it. And this week, just like the Browns did a couple weeks ago, they put their players in the best position to win. I don't know what it is about Colt McCoy, but I think Brian Daboll really likes working with him. He's utilizing him in ways that are putting Colt in that place where he can be most successful. He's rolling him out of the pocket. He is using the play action pass, which I think McCoy does an excellent job of faking the run. So if it's that McCoy is a rookie and is willing to just pretty much do whatever Daboll wants, whereas the two veteran quarterbacks came in and had worked in other systems. I don't know what it is, but there seems to be a chemistry there between Brian Daboll's play calling and Colt McCoy's execution. And Colt is executing this offense. Again, his stat line doesn't scream terrific performance. It was 14 for 19, which is a 73.6% completion percentage. That is pretty impressive. But 14 for 19, 174 yards, no touchdowns, no interceptions. But anyone who watched the game knows that Colt outplayed future Hall of Famer Tom Brady. That doesn't make Colt a future Hall of Famer, but it does make Colt the clear choice, in my mind, to be the Browns' starting quarterback going forward. He's the only one that's healthy, so he should be the starting quarterback by default, and I think that he will get another start by default next week against the Jets. But at this point, after this performance, with the poise that he played with the playmaking ability that he showed for the first time, when he had that play in the third quarter, he tried to fake the handoff to Hillis. Hillis wasn't there. It was some type of screw-up. But instead of panicking, going crazy, he calmly rolled out to the right side, threw a great ball. He throws an excellent ball on the run, a dart to Brian Robiskie. That impressed me so much. And then he, of course, followed that up with that physical run for the touchdown. Colt is not just the healthiest of the quarterbacks. He's not just the best statistically. He is. He has the best completion percentage on the team at 67.6%, the most yards per game at 168. He's not just the quarterback who has the best intangibles, which I think he does. He is actually now the quarterback that I think gives the Browns the best chance to win. This is the ideal situation. Colt is proving that he can grow from week to week, become a better quarterback week to week, and at the same time give you the best chance to win. He's not perfect. He is a work in progress, but there's just something about him. There's this intangible element about him. He is a playmaker. He is, in the most cliche way possible, he's a football player. He doesn't seem rattled by anything. He's the first quarterback ever to start his career playing his first three games against Super Bowl winning quarterbacks with Ben Roethlisberger, Drew Brees, and Tom Brady. And young Colt McCoy is 2-1 in those starts. That is not a fluke. And Eric Mangini needs to ride this Colt as far as he can possibly take him. So at this point, I think the elements are there. We've seen the excellent play continue from the special teams. They forced a big turnover. The defense has played great these last 2 weeks, only allowing 14 points, seven of which were basically in garbage time. And the key to this defense has been stopping the run. They held the Patriots well under 100 yards rushing, only 69 yards rushing for this particular game. So the defense has been excellent. They've got a tough matchup coming up against the New York Jets, but I think the Browns are capable of matching the Jets' physicality in a way that a lot of teams in the NFL can't. So I think it's going to be a very hard-fought game. You know Mangini wants to win this one really bad too, so the coaches are probably going to have something up their sleeve again. And it's so exciting for Browns football to be relevant again. This is a respectable NFL team. It's heading down the path that I think Mangini always envisioned, and they've proven now, two straight weeks, that they can be a winning football team. That's the next step on the path. The step after that is proving they can do it week to week. And after the Jets, they're going to enter into a softer portion of their schedule for the next five games. So they get an opportunity over these last eight games of the season to finish this thing out and try to prove that not only are they a respectable team, but a team that week to week can bring a consistent winning style of football. Well, now that we've had a few episodes of the program, I'm happy to say that some of you have taken the opportunity to contact me, not just with show feedback, which I greatly appreciate, but also with some questions that you're interested in hearing my thoughts on. And so we've got a new segment for you, Ask the Exiled Clevelander, where I take on your questions.
I'll answer your questions. You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
Ask the Exiled Clevelander.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
All right, well, for this first edition of Ask the Exiled Clevelander, I'm actually joined by a second Exiled Clevelander. He joins me again, show contributor Ryan. What's going on, man?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on to answer a couple of these listener questions, which I'm pleased to have received. Let's get right to it here. The first one comes from somebody calling himself Big Mike 34. He posted it as a comment to the show's webpage at exiledclevelander.wordpress.com. He writes, "We have only one RB running back of any value, no speed left in the backfield, not even any slow of value left in the backfield. It is Hillis and that is it. We have no wide receiver of any value, so we must rely on a tight end-oriented passing game and throw to Hillis. Our best QB is a snot-nosed rookie," he does note in parentheses, "with promise. The best two after him have broken wheels. Even our Pro Bowl left tackle has a bum shoulder or something else is wrong with him. The offensive coordinator is just not up to the job. He just doesn't know what the heck he is doing. The head coach is a horrible game day coach." Then he asks in all caps, "That is the offense. Now, how many games do you think we will win?" Now, in Big Mike's defense, he wrote this question on the webpage before he had the benefit of seeing the Browns shellack the Patriots all over the football field. So we'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that one. But he wants to know how many games the Browns can win. And, of course, you and I have the benefit of watching that game. What do you think? How many games do you think they can win this year?
I would have hoped that he would have typed that before the Browns totally embarrassed Bill Belichick this past Sunday, because it'd be hard to imagine someone writing that after having watched that game.
Well, he did write it after they beat the Saints, though. So, Big Mike, obviously not much of an optimist. Are you a bigger optimist than Big Mike?
But one game you could say is a fluke. But two games like this, you have to begin to credit Mangini and the work ethic of the players. So I think it's harder to be a pessimist having seen two surprising upset games like that. And I think given that, I'm actually fairly bullish on the rest of the season, I think. I see the Browns potentially going 5-3. For the remainder of the season, to finish 8-8.
I think I'm pretty much on the same page with you. If you look at the rest of the Browns' schedule, they, of course, have the Jets coming up this Sunday, but then they don't face another team with a winning record until the second to last week of the season when they face the Ravens at home at 6-2. The schedule shapes up. They go on the road to Jacksonville after the Jets this upcoming week. Jacksonville has looked very erratic. Home against Carolina, they've looked terrible. Away against Miami, they've been erratic. Buffalo has zero wins at this point. Then Cincinnati, they look like the worst team in the AFC North right now, and then they finish the season with Baltimore and Pittsburgh. So you look at that five-game stretch, the Browns are in the worst part of their schedule right now, and then they have this five-game stretch. If they can go 3-2 in that five-game stretch and then win one of the three against the three remaining winning teams, that right there, which I think is kind of a conservative estimate, that puts them at four more wins and ending the season mark at 7-9. So I can definitely see 7-9. I could see 8-8. Any chance you think they get above 500?
Yeah, I do think there is a chance, because the way that I break it down, there's a good chance that they'll lose against the Jets this week. The Jets are pretty good against the run. And so, as Big Mike points out, you know, if you have to rely on Peyton Hillis for a lot of the offense, that could be a problem against the Jets. Against Jacksonville, you know, they did beat Indianapolis at home, but their defense hasn't been particularly good this season. So So I see that being a win. As you say, Carolina looks like that could be a win. Miami, I'm actually putting down as a loss because we have to play in Miami, even though they're 0-3 at home so right now. But I see, in part, I have to give Miami a loss just because I really don't see us winning 5 in a row. I think the team is showing some promise, but I don't think they're going to pull off a 5-in-a-row streak here towards the end of the season. But so I'm going to put that one down as a loss. But Buffalo looks terrible. Cincinnati doesn't look very good, so I see those as both wins. And then I see Baltimore. I think that that's going to be a win, if only because I don't see us going 0-4 against our chief divisional rivals in the Steelers and the Ravens. And then I don't see us losing, or I don't see us winning against Pittsburgh, particularly their first in run defense in the league right now. So I think that could be a really hard for us to win that one.
I think at the very least, those last two games are going to be very interesting. The Browns may not have a whole lot to play for at that point, but I think they will have a definite spoiler role to play and could very well decide who wins the division or even whether or not either of those teams go to the playoffs. But let me ask you this. You're talking about an 8-8 record. I think I'm about there with you, 8-8, maybe 7-9. If they get lucky, they'd have to get really lucky and stay consistent, which honestly we haven't seen yet. We haven't seen the consistency, but I'm not going to take 9-7 off the table. What do you think it's going to take for Eric Mangini, though, to keep his job?
I think if they finish better than 7-9, I think that there's a good shot that he would keep his job. And I think that from Holmgren's perspective, if he sees an opportunity to go with a guy that he really likes, like a Gruden, then maybe there's nothing that Mangini can do to protect his job. Because Holmgren, if he sees a guy that he really wants it, that he has a connection to, and he can sort of remake the team in his image, in a sense, maybe there's no stopping that. But I have to think that if the team goes 7-9 or better, then it would be really hard, particularly if the team finishes playing strong for Mangini, to say that you should break up the coaching leadership and throw the team into disarray with a new guy. Right now, the players look like they like playing for Mangini. We all saw them dump the Gatorade on him at the end of the Patriots game. They need to stop
showering the coaches with Gatorade. This is the second straight game. I don't know if you saw it. 2 weeks ago, they showered Rob Ryan with Gatorade. So they need to quit the Gatorade baths for a team when they're 2-5 and now 3-5. But
I agree. But I think it shows that this team is really behind the coaching staff right now. And I think that that's going to count for something. So if things continue as they are, I think that's really going to count a lot for Mangini sticking around for another season.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page. If they get to 7-9, that will have meant that after starting the season 1-5, they finish the season 6-4. And I think that's probably enough to keep them around as long as they're competitive throughout all the games. So there you go, Big Mike. We're thinking this team could win 8 wins, which honestly, just a few weeks ago, I wouldn't have thought that.
I just want to say, if this team can win 8 wins, those early losses that the team was in really look pretty bad.
Yes.
That hurts a lot.
Yeah, I don't think that especially the way they looked in those first two games, that anyone had any illusions that they would even be a fringe playoff team. I don't think 9-7 is even good enough to make the playoffs, especially in the AFC this year. But yeah, those would certainly hurt. if they do as well as we're thinking that they might, those losses would certainly hurt. So moving on to Jake, who writes me at the show email address, which is exiledclevelander@gmail.com. Jake states, Adam, you talk about bracing for this Cavs season like it will be a roller coaster ride. shouldn't we actually hope that they just crash and burn so that they can truly begin the process of rebuilding this team with a high draft pick? Well, right now they're not crashing and burning. I mean, they looked kind of shaky, as I stated in the show last week. After winning that very emotional win against the Celtics, they came back, looked terrible against Toronto, looked bad against Sacramento, lost again to Atlanta, and were 1-3. But now they've rallied a bit with a couple nice road wins against Philadelphia and Washington. What do you think? Do you agree with Jake? Do they need to crash and burn to try to get that high draft pick, to try to get that superstar back in the fold if possible? Or can they use more of an incremental approach?
My feeling is, as a fan, I would love to see them, I would love to see them make it to the playoffs this year. Right now, if the season ended today, the Cavs would be the 4 seed, Miami would be the 5 seed. That would be wonderful. I would love to see that happen.
Wonderful, wonderful until the Heat swept us in 4 games.
Yeah, but even if that happened, it would still be a great thing to see the team in the playoffs when no one expected them to make it even into the playoffs. That 12-win prediction, for instance. So, as a fan, and as someone who's seen the movie Major League more times than I can count, you have to want passionately to see your team win against all odds. But there's a reason why Major League is Hollywood, and we're not going to have a movie where Charlie Sheen plays Booby Gibson and hits the three-pointer to win the playoff berth.
And that's because Booby Gibson doesn't have a coke habit either that we know about.
Well, that we know about. You know, I don't know. You look at some of those hair designs, and maybe he does.
Good point.
But so as a fan, there's nothing more that I would like to see than that kind of fantasy play out. But I just don't think that that's realistic to think that that's going to happen. At best, this team is probably a marginal playoff team, an 8th seed probably at best, once the dust settles. So I just don't see that as being worth it. Whereas if you look at what this team needs to do in order to get competitive again, and not just competitive like 4th or 5th seed competitive, but competitive in a way that they could win a championship, which is clearly something that Dan Gilbert wants to do, then your options really become, in general, your options for winning a championship and getting talent, you either have to get free agency, you have to make a good trade, or you have to pick up talent in the draft. And so with free agency, after the decision debacle, I think it's going to be really hard for the Cavs to attract top shelf free agent talent, and they're likely to have to overpay to get second tier free agent talent. So I don't see the free agent market as being the secret for this team getting the kind of talent it needs. You know, maybe to fill in some pieces, but I don't see it as being the answer. With trading, the Cavs were kind of lucky because, with the exception of some of Dan Ferry's early moves, he was actually really good at putting together some trades to pick up pieces that they thought, at least at the time, they needed. Now, is Chris Gent going to be anywhere near as good as Ferry at that? We really don't know at this point, but I'm a little bit skeptical that he's going to be able to get what we need through trades. And, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical that we have a whole lot of trading value to work with other than maybe Andy Barajal. So then that leaves the best option being the draft, and you look at the impact that a guy like Kevin Durant has had, Blake Griffin is having on the Clippers. You know, one guy can, at the top of the draft, can make a huge difference, and so I see that being the fastest way for this team to get competitive again. So I think getting a top lottery pick is the best way for them to go.
Well, here's where you and I go separate ways. I do agree with you that as a fan, you certainly want to see the team succeed. I just don't know. I'm certainly not hoping that they crash and burn, both for that reason and because I'm not convinced that the superstar model in today's NBA, the way it's structured, really is what's going to lead you to a championship. It's interesting that you mentioned Kevin Durant and Blake Griffin. Griffin does look impressive, but the Clippers still suck. And as good as Durant has looked, he led the U.S. world team to that gold medal over the summer. And as much praise and hype as this Oklahoma City team has received, they haven't won anything. They haven't even won a playoff series yet and have looked a little uneasy going forward in this season. I went and took a look back the last 10 years, actually the last 11 years, and looked at the teams that won the NBA championship. The sad part for us as Cavs fans is in those 10 years, only five different franchises actually won the titles. The Lakers, the Celtics, the Spurs, the Heat, and the Pistons. But if you look at those teams and you analyze how they got their talent, the only team that had a high first-round draft pick and basically built entirely through the draft was the Spurs. When they drafted Tim Duncan, they had a very odd situation where they had a bunch of injured players. I think David Robinson was out in 1996, and then they landed Duncan in the draft in 97. Robinson came back. And all of a sudden in 1999, they had a title. They followed that up in 2003 with another title. But I think that that's the exception, not the rule. I mean, Dwayne Wade was the fifth pick in 2003, and he, of course, won that title with the Heat in 2006, but he needed Shaq, who was acquired via trade, to do it. So, you know, you look at Kobe, he's a superstar. I'll agree that you might need at least a superstar to contend for a title. But Kobe was the 13th pick in the draft, and he doesn't win those first set of titles without Shaq there, and he was brought in as a free agent. And he doesn't win these last two titles without Paul Gasol coming via trade and Lamar Odom coming via a trade. So to those people out there, and I'm not saying that you're necessarily saying this, but I think that there's a lot of people out there, and Jake may be representative of this, that just want the Cavs to lose, to tank, and end up with the first overall pick. And I just don't think that leads to riches. I mean, we had the first overall pick. We had the back-to-back MVP, and we made the finals once and got swept. So I just don't think that those high draft picks, even if you get that blue chip superstar or the panacea that some people make them out to be, I think the model that Dan Gilbert probably is thinking about, since he is a Detroit native, is the 2004 Pistons, and they were a very interesting team. The core of that team, only Tayshaun Prince was actually drafted by the Pistons. He was the 23rd pick in 2002, 2 years before they won. Everyone else, Chauncey Billups, he was signed as a free agent. Rip Hamilton came over in a trade. Rasheed Wallace was traded for the year they won the title, and Ben Wallace was an undrafted free agent who was traded to the Pistons. That's probably the model that Dan Gilbert is thinking of following, and I agree with you that it's probably going to be difficult to get the top-level free agent talent, so that's probably the model that they're going to have to pursue if they're going to win it. But do you think that they can do and build around a superstar in a way they were unable to when a certain number 23 was patrolling around the Quicken Loans Arena?
Well, I think that you have to acknowledge that the team was really good when LeBron was here. Sure, they never managed to put it together where it really counted, but they did have back-to-back 60-plus win seasons and were favored to go really far in the playoffs.
But we're talking about winning a title, you know, and these people that argue for tearing down the whole team, they argue that that means is justified by the end of winning a title, not, you know, being a successful playoff team. You know, I think there's an outside chance this particular group of guys, and I don't know if it's going to happen, but there's an outside chance that they could be a halfway decent playoff team. Who knows? But if you're going to tear down the team, you want to build a champion. We didn't have that the first time around.
Well, that's definitely true. But I think, you know, all the teams that you just mentioned all did have at least one top flight talent guy.
Who was the Pistons?
Well, on the Pistons, let's see, they had Chauncey Billups, right?
You'd call him a top-flight talent?
I think in the year that they won, he had a good season. And he I think he was good. And, you know, sure, you know, any guy can have a breakout season once. But, I mean, and maybe the Pistons were the exception to the rule. But every other team that you mentioned had at least one great guy. And as you pointed out, many of them needed multiple excellent players in order to get there. So I think that if you want to add one really good player, you're going to have to do it through the draft, I think, unless you have things that you can really trade for. And so in the absence of not knowing what kind of general manager the Cavs have right now, I think the best way to put the team in a position to succeed is to go for a high lottery pick. And otherwise, I think you're putting a whole lot of faith in the fact that they can cobble together a whole bunch of question marks and make that team run. Now, you might have a shot there because I think we have a head coach who has shown that he can take some guys who aren't the best talent in the league and make them play well together. You know, he did that. He's done that with his past two teams. Then again, I mean, he had Jason Kidd, who was, you know, certainly not anymore a top flight guy, but was very good in his prime. So, and he had Chris Paul too. So with the Hornets. So I think you need to have at least one good guy, and I see the draft as being the only realistic option for this team.
Well, can we both at least agree that it's going to take more than just getting the lottery pick?
Oh, I agree. You have to get that. You have to get lucky. I mean, so much of it is luck. I mean, maybe a big part of it was, you know, in another era, maybe the Cavs would have won multiple championships with number 23, but they happened to be playing in an era where you had to go through Orlando with Dwight Howard, which the Cavs weren't able to solve, or you had to face Boston with the big three. So, I mean, part of it's luck, part of it's timing. One group of guys might be successful in one situation and not match up well in another. So, I mean, yeah, you know, it's going to take more than one player. I agree with you on that.
Well, we know in Cleveland we have a lot of things, but luck is generally not one of them.
As Dan Gilbert said, number 23 took the curse to South Beach, so I think things are changing.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope they start pulling more hamstrings or something down there. You know, one last thing I'll say about this whole lottery thing. I mean, my worry is you tear down the team, you get the lottery pick. I mean, we've already agreed that you need more than just the lottery pick if you're going to build a championship contender. I mean, if you look at Oklahoma City as the model, I don't think they're title contenders at this point, and they've been doing that rebuilding project for over 5 years. So I wonder if there is a in-between way of doing it. I'm not sure if it exists. I'm not sure if the Pistons model is even realistic in today's NBA, where you have these apparent super teams that are forming in Boston and Miami and possibly the Knicks. But me personally, I'm not sure if tanking the season or ending up with that high lottery pick is worth it in the end if you've had to gut your team of all your talent to get there. So I guess we'll just have to agree to disagree on this one. But I want to thank Big Mike and Jake for taking time to write into the program. And Ryan, I'd like to thank you for coming on and helping me to answer their questions.
Thanks a lot.
Well, before we wrap it up here, want to send a special shout out to the fine producers of the Cavs Zine. underground media publication by Cavs fans for Cavs fans. The mysterious character known on Twitter as at Wayne Embry's Kids sent me a copy of the first Cavs Zine, which has J.J. Hickson, known as The Hickson, on the cover. This is a truly unique publication that if you are a Cavs fan, you need to get your hands on. And my understanding is if you contact Wayne Embry's Kids via Twitter, as I did, he will send you one of these things, and he will even pay for the postage, which makes the publication even better. It's free, and it'll come to your door free of charge. So thanks again to him, and excellent job by the whole Cavs Zine crew. I look forward to reading further editions of the publication, and hopefully we can get one of you on the podcast to get your thoughts on how this Cavs season is shaping up. Want to remind you that you can subscribe to the show on the show's webpage at exiledclevelander.wordpress.com. There's a sign me up link in the upper right-hand corner of the site that will enable you to receive an automatic email each time a new episode is posted. So really encourage you to check that out. The show is also now on Facebook. You can just search for the Exiled Clevelander podcast. Hopefully you'll see it in your heart to go over there and like the show on Facebook. And then you can reach me at exiledclevelander@gmail.com or on Twitter, Exiled Clevelander. That's EXILEDCLEVELNDR. Or leave a comment on the website. Feedback always appreciated. And if you've got questions for the Ask the Exiled Clevelander segment, I'd love to hear them. I will talk to you on the next episode. I'm Adam Copeland. Thanks so much for listening to the Exiled Clevelander podcast.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.